Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we welcome back Nick from The Frequent Miler. Nick, it's great to have you back on the show.
Excited to be back here again. Love talking to you guys last time, and it's been a while. I haven't had a chance to catch up with you, so I'm excited to have a chance to talk some miles and points.
Yeah. So great to have you back.
It really has been a while, and I feel like you've done so many things in since we've last talked to you. Just looking at a couple of the high points, I think you did the JetBlue 25 for 25, not just you as an individual, but as a family?
Yeah, wow. We did it as a family of four. Yeah, my wife and I and our two sons. Really, that was the thing that I couldn't resist because, I love to take advantage of all the various promotions and opportunities to game things, but this particular one, I don't know if I would have necessarily done it on my own. It was, for me, the draw was, wow, I could get my kids airline status that could last for 25 years. And so, my kids are 8 and 5 now, and the thought of them maybe graduating from college and getting their first job and still getting an extra legroom seat because of something that I laid the foundation for now, that just seemed wild to me. So who knows whether JetBlue will last, but if they do, that was too much of an opportunity for me to turn down. So, yeah, we completed it.
That's so cool. Did you do that primarily I think you could use JetBlue points to redeem for the flights, or did you do cash or kind of a mix?
Yeah, so you're right. You could use JetBlue points, but no, I didn't use very many JetBlue points. Mostly what we used were Amex membership rewards points, because if you have a business platinum card, you can use the points for travel on your chosen airline at 1.5 cents per point. So I had done the math and figured that we could probably get the whole thing done for somewhere around 600,000 Amex membership rewards points and end up with a total among the four of us of about 1.4 million JetBlue miles. And of course, because JetBlue allows pooling, that really is like a 1.4 million all-in-one lump that we can use together to book whatever it is we want. So that was my plan, was to primarily use Amex points, and primarily that's what we did. We did book some with cash because there was a Citi merchant offer for $50 back on 200 at JetBlue, and a couple of other things like that. I used the Altitude Reserve, which no longer, unfortunately, allows points to be used at 1.5 cents per point towards travel, but at the time they did. So I used that to book a couple of cash flights. We used the Capital One Venture X cards, $300 annual travel credit to book a flight or two through the Capital One travel portal. So there was a little bit of a mix of a couple of things like that, but the vast majority of it was booked with Amex membership rewards points because I didn't want to be out of pocket for a ton of money on this. And luckily, we've created lots of points over the years. So we had plenty of Amex points to be able to support that and get this done without putting a ton of cash out of pocket into it. That's not to say we didn't spend anything. I mean, we spent some money. We also did book a couple of awards through other partners like Etihad Guest. You can book JetBlue flights with Etihad Guest, and there's some fantastic value to be had there. It's a horrible program overall because their cancellation policy is awful. And so it's not a program I would generally recommend that people spend much time or effort learning about. However, it can be really useful for a last-minute JetBlue flight when you're pretty sure plans aren't going to change. We flew to Martha's Vineyard and we flew to Milwaukee at times when awards were surprisingly available given the fact that cash prices were really high, both to fly to Martha's Vineyard and the particular flight we needed to get to Milwaukee. We had to get there, unfortunately, for a funeral, so it was not flexible. It was the exact day and time that we needed, and the cost was very high compared to general JetBlue flights, yet it was available as an award through Etihad Guest. So we were able to take advantage of that a couple of times, too.
Yeah, I think I had a very similar experience, because I used it where I didn't see availability on American or on, was it on Alaska or something else, but I did find a JetBlue flight and I had all these Etihad miles that were going to expire because, again, their expiration policy is not great at all. So, so I was like, hey, I've got this stash that, I think I earned from a Hyatt promo a long time ago was going to expire. And I was like, it's not a great point efficient redemption, but great for me because it was going to, if I didn't do something something with it, it was just going to go poof.
And that's also a good tip on the Amex membership rewards points. I feel like I've discounted the value of that the 40% rebate when paying with points now, because it just feels so limiting. But obviously, you found a way to make it to just thrive with it. So bravo there.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's not the world's finest membership rewards points redemption, because you just get a little bit over 1.5 cents per point in value. But in this case, we were getting 1.5 cents per point in value. We were earning JetBlue points, of course, from the flights and tiles and all that, which didn't necessarily matter to us a ton, but we did earn some points anyway. And then, of course, we were earning this big bonus, because after we hit all 25 destinations, we'd end up with the 1.4 million points. So when you consider that rebate as well, we did pretty well for the points, and then, you know, have Mosaic status for the next 25 years. And also, JetBlue allows a choice benefit. And so for this year, we took tiles. My family gifted me tiles because I'm trying to get to Mosaic 2 for this year. But I've been told now that JetBlue's intention is that will be something you can choose every single year. And one of the options is 15,000 points. So if the four of us take that, we're going to get another 60,000 points every year for the next 24 years from JetBlue. So, you know, when you consider that too, I'm happy with having used the Amex points at 1.5 cents per point. I haven't found myself unable to make other redemptions I want to, because thankfully I had a good balance of membership rewards points, or good enough anyway.
Yeah, that definitely sounds like that's an investment that's going to pay dividends for many years to come. So if we could just pivot a little bit, we don't normally talk necessarily about like breaking news, but Hyatt came out with some award chart changes. I think you covered that. And I thought I thought you had an interesting perspective, because and we've got an episode that'll probably come out before this. So we're trying to get an episode out kind of weekly for a couple of weeks, just a little bit of a blitz, just because there's so much going on. And my initial feel was, oh, I gotta speculatively make all these bookings, like, you know, transfer all my ultimate rewards points into Hyatt and just get these things going, because I've got some big trips coming up this year that I just can't find the flights for, like trying to get to Japan and stuff. But like, I know we're going to try to get there. And you seem to take a different approach where you were just, I think you proposed just be intentional, not necessarily a huge rush to make a lot of speculative bookings.
Sure. I think that I understand where you took that from, but I think that's misinterpreting a little bit, or at least misinterpreting my intention, not necessarily what I wrote, but my intention when I wrote it. Because yes, I did write recently saying don't panic, because I think long term, Hyatt points are still going to be valuable. They are not going to be as valuable for the top end, most outsized redemptions in the future, but I think that they will continue to be the most valuable hotel currency by a good stretch. So I don't think it makes sense to say, okay, I need to burn all my Hyatt points now and, you know, burn it all to the ground and move on to something different, because I'm not going to stay at Hyatt again after this new award chart comes out. I think that's the wrong approach, because I think there's still going to be tons of value to be had, particularly at the lower and mid tiers. And certainly for people who have flexibility to travel during off-peak seasons, I think there's still going to be plenty of opportunity to do well. And your free night certificates are going to continue to be valuable, et cetera, et cetera. I think it makes sense to prioritize those trips where, you know, like you said, if you've been wanting to go to Japan and you've always wanted to stay at the Park Hyatt in Tokyo or the Hyatt Regency, it's close to Mount Fuji. I can't think of the name of it right now. I can't think of the name. It's sort of like a hidden Park Hyatt. It's a gorgeous property. But if you've had that type of place or the Park Hyatt Kyoto on your list and you're like, oh, I've wanted to go there, then yeah, it makes sense. Book that now, because that's going to cost way more in the future. And you may not want to pay the cost for it when you get that trip booked someday. I'd say push aside the trip you were going to do this year and prioritize that type of redemption now. So I think that makes a lot of sense, prioritizing the places that you're like, this is a bucket list thing for me, and I'm going to be priced out when they start pricing these things much higher, so I should do that now. I don't think that you should blow through all of your Hyatt points because you think they're not going to work later. Now, to your point about speculative bookings, that's one thing that's really special about award travel is that you can make lots of speculative bookings now. And so if you book the Park Hyatt in Kyoto and then later on you're like, you know what? It's just not going to happen. You can cancel it and have your points back and, you know, and life moves on. So I think it's fine to make speculative bookings. I think my caution was more so to tell people, don't just look to burn them every which way you can because you don't expect that they're going to be as valuable in the future. I'm still going to continue to hang on to points. I sure did make some speculative bookings that I may or may not keep for places that I assume I'm not going to want to pay the price for in the future. And if I don't keep them, I'll get the points back. But I'm not going to necessarily say, okay, at all costs, I'm going to make those redemptions happen. Because if they don't work out, oh, well, my Hyatt points will still have a good use and find a good use in the future, I think.
I think that's well said. And just for clarity, I wasn't saying burn it to the ground. I still believe right. there's a future in Hyatt, but I do. Yeah. I am in the make a ton of speculative bookings camp.
Yes. I think that makes sense. I think making speculative bookings certainly makes sense because you may not be able to get those later on or certainly not at the prices that you're used to. So definitely if you've got the points to use, there's no harm in locking some things up. I think I got the sense from some people that said, oh, they want to just use up all their Hyatt points right now and cancel their Hyatt card because they don't think it's going to be as valuable when things go up in price. Yeah. And I think that that's the wrong perspective. Like, don't go out there and make a booking that's only going to give you 1.5 cents per point because you don't think you're going to get 2 cents later on. I think maybe you will get 2 cents later on. You're probably not going to get 8 cents later on. You know, so that type of thing, you know, your Park Hyatt Kyoto's or your super expensive properties, some of these Hyatt properties go for, you know, $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 a night, sometimes more in peak season, where you're getting just amazing value for your points. Now, it's not uncommon to get 3, 4, 5, 6 cents per point at some of those types of places. And in the future, I think those are going to be far closer to 2 cents or less. So they'll still be good, but not nearly as good as they are now. And less
I think
exciting.
I've just resigned myself never to stay at the Andaz Maui. I think Andaz Maui is not in my future.
right. That's and I've had to do that with several myself and say, you know what, that's just not going to be in my future because I'm not going to pay the $75,000 that they're going to want to charge in the future. That's too many points for me to consider. Even if it is a good deal compared to the cash rates are certifiably insane to me. So, you know, but that's okay. I can accept that. You know, however, if I've always wanted the Andaz Maui. And this year we were planning on going to the south of France instead, just to throw out an example. I might say, you know what? Actually, let's go to the Andaz Maui because we're not going to go there next year. We can go to France next year. France will still be there and probably still offer decent value. Maybe not the Hyatt Regency in Nice, which, of course, is the
I was about to say that's almost the Andaz too, right?
Right. Right. Probably a poor example, but that's the idea
Hyatt's
that I
at
would
the beach.
Prioritize.
That's apparently
this.
The trend, right?
Hyatt's at the beach, yeah.
Hyatt's at the beach.
Yeah.
I agree with you, though. I think the days of the Paris Vendome Park Hyatt, that's another one. I mean, you know, beautiful hotel, but at some point it just becomes, is the juice worth the squeeze? Oof, I'm tongue-tied today.
No, it is. It's true. And it's also, to me, you know, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the cash value of my points. You know, I don't do tons of calculations. And I also don't spend a lot of time thinking, okay, we just spent 60,000 points per person times four. That's $2,400 or more, you know, 1 cent per point. I don't often get too tripped up in that because we do earn a lot of points and redeem a lot of points. But when we get to the point where it's like, okay, I got to transfer 75,000 points from Chase that I could redeem for $750 in cash to get a single night at a top tier category 8 when it's peak price. At that point, I've got to stop myself and say, wait, this is getting silly. I could take the $750 and book a place that I'm perfectly content with for $150, $250, $350 and pocket the other $350 or hold on to it for another day. Yeah. I'm not going to spend $750 worth of points on a night.
You know, that doesn't seem reasonable. Does make me think a little bit, you know, from a trend perspective, because, you know, it feels like, you know, the inflation kind of at the high end, you know, on the premium side, you know, the Park Hyatts and some of the more desirable, properties, you know, some of those I feel like have had a much higher rise maybe in the overall kind of cash rates. And in this case, the points are now catching up than maybe, you know, some of the more mid-tier type properties, you know, have had in the past. Because, you know, again, mm-hmm. you know, in my experience, you know, I would occasionally, you know, pay cash rates for a luxury hotel because I think it's worth it. But, you know, when you start seeing things rise above $500 a night, and I'm like, wow, that's, to me, that's starting to get into a range where I just feel like, wow, that just seems like a lot of money to splurge, you know, so I'm just much less likely to do it. But yet the market is supporting that. I guess there are people who are wealthy, or there is, you know, a demand at the top. And, you know, I think what we just see what Miles and Points doing is, again, kind of, adjusting to meet kind of the new market that exists. And I don't think I'm exaggerating or hallucinating when I think that some of these higher end hotels are just getting even more expensive at a much steeper rate than some of the other hotels that are toward the bottom.
I mean, you can only call some hotels aspirational so long before it goes to the general manager's head, right?
Yeah, that's right.
that must be it. No, I think that's a really astute observation, though, because I think you're right. I think that there still remain those mid-tier properties that have gone up in price, but not so much that it feels unattainable or starts to make you question, is this ridiculous? But at the top end, things have really soared. And like you said, I appreciate a luxury property as much as anybody. I value those luxury property redemptions differently, because I'm getting not just the room, but I'm also getting the experience that I appreciate and enjoy, the location where I want to be, you know, some of the amenities that I want to have. So I do recognize that there is some value to be had in staying at a luxury property. I don't deny that at all. But the rate at which they've risen, you're right, is just, I think, difficult to stomach. Especially if you're somebody who's a dedicated Miles and Points person who loves getting great value out of your points, and then you're probably not the kind of person who, even if it is, you know, not only possible but easy enough for you to be able to do that. I mean, if you're positioned to be able to afford to splurge and splash out on the fancy property, I think if you're a Miles and Points person, you're probably the kind of person who, even if that's easy enough to afford, you're also still kind of like, but wait a second, is this silly? You know, like I'm used to getting great value, and it feels less like a great value if I got to spend, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $8,000 or whatever it may be. Though, like you said, the market clearly supports it. Man, there's lots of places that are charging that much and getting it. So who am I to question that, I guess?
It's also regional, too. Like, I feel like, you know, North America, you know, big cities in Europe, maybe like Japan, you know, those are places where this is, I think what we just talked about is true. Large swaths of the planet, though, are still kind of, you know, stuck in a different kind of price tier. And some of these, you know, super high luxury, you know, can be had, I think, at great value, you know, at least for our American, both dollars and American loyalty currency for that matter as well, you know, because, you know, significant parts of Southeast Asia, significant parts of, you know, I would imagine Africa or some other places where, you know, you just haven't seen the same rise in values of at least of these type of commodities, where, you know, I think if you're talking about like New York City or Hawaii or, you know, London, you know, these are not affordable destinations for the high end luxury anymore, because they're all very expensive.
I mean, they're barely affordable at the mid tier, right? I was just looking at Paris, and even the Hyatt Regency is what I think 20 or 25,000 points.
Yikes!
And then that's not even talking about the closer in ones over by the Louvre and such. So I mean, I think some cities are just naturally pricing themselves out of, you know, that kind of value market. But even when you look at some place like Bangkok, I did a little bit of an analysis trying to decide between the Hyatt Regency, the Grand Hyatt, and the Park Hyatt. And it just felt like the Park Hyatt was just so much more in a city that you largely expect to be very inexpensive, which led me back to the Grand Hyatt as the best value. Maybe it's just, you know, maybe it's just the location. Maybe it's just the fact that I've been to the Grand Hyatt a few times and I've got a, you know, it's got a special place in my heart. But I just felt like, you know, you look at that delta for the Park Hyatt in Bangkok, even though everybody talks, you know, nicely about it, and it just didn't feel like, again, the juice wasn't worth the squeeze for that premium.
That's true. That's true. I think all of those points really, to me, tell me that it's time to kind of branch out a little bit and look at the other places because, you know, to your point, TK, that there are plenty of places out there where you can still get great value that may not have been on the list that you thought you had, but maybe should be on your list because there are plenty of great places to discover and plenty of places where luxury is still affordable, but just may not have been top of mind. And so it encourages me to look for those opportunities and say, okay, well, when the new charts come out, where can I find that experience for a great value? Because it exists out there somewhere. And the nice thing about being a Points and Miles Award traveler is wherever it is, it's going to be accessible. You know, even if it would be expensive to get there, you know, with a cash ticket, you can get there on a flight with miles and points probably and for a decent deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a great segue, I think. You know, talking about being able to find award flights to get to far-reaching places. So I wanted to sort of pivot to Aeroplan. Last time you were on, we talked about that because it seemed like it was a key pillar of your challenge or your strategy for the challenge. Are you still seeing that kind of value with Aeroplan? Are you still like finding opportunities to do some of those hopscotches with the stopover and with the the multiple legs, et cetera?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question in a number of ways. So first of all, like my first reaction to that is, yes, there are still plenty of those opportunities. And yes, I'm still seeing plenty of them. I'm not necessarily seeing plenty of them that my family wants to join me on because there are times where I would love to book that 5-stop itinerary and my wife shuts that down. So there are, but there's definitely been a change. There's no doubt. I think that the move to more dynamic pricing with more of their partners has been hugely disappointing. Oftentimes when, United is involved on an itinerary that just causes the price to become very unfavorable very quickly. And that stinks for people that aren't located at a major international gateway type of a hub. I think it makes it particularly difficult. So I think that there are definitely some downsides. But the flip side for me is still that Aeroplan still has more airline partners than anybody in the world. So there are more different options available to you when you're booking an Aeroplan award. And the ability to add a stopover for 5,000 additional points isn't quite as good as Alaska's free stopover. But because they have so many partnerships, it gives you so many more options for where you want to have that stopover. And I've also enjoyed the ability to mix so many different partners on an individual award. So I think it still is a great program. I think it's lost some of its luster with these dynamically priced charts for some of the partners that are most desirable. It's also been difficult, not just for Aeroplan, but everyone, because many airlines just seem to be releasing less availability, or maybe they're releasing the same amount. There's more of us competing for the space. I don't know which it is, but it does seem anecdotally that it's harder for a lot of people anyway to find the awards that they want to find. Now, I say that, and just last night, my wife was asking me if we could change plans and go to Europe a different day. And I said, so you're asking me to change a plan to go to Europe with 5 people in business class during summer travel dates? You want to push that by a couple of days? Huh? No big deal. Easy enough, right? I was being facetious, of course, because I thought there's no way I'm going to find 5 seats in business class on another itinerary 3 or 4 or 5 days later to, you know, be able to squeeze in something else we want to do. But then I got looking at it, and sure enough, I found some opportunities that existed that were available. By widening my net a little bit and saying, okay, well, what if I'm willing to position here, or what if I'm willing to fly into a different place? And I love award search tools because they help me find those things. You know, maybe the destinations that I wouldn't have considered necessarily. I wouldn't have looked for that particular route, but the award search tool helped me find it. So I think that there are still some good opportunities. This summer, I'm going to have an Aeroplan award. It's not going to be a terribly exciting Aeroplan award, unfortunately. unfortunately, because like I said, I'm just not at that stage right now with my family where they're interested in the super complicated itineraries. So I've had to dial it back a notch. I think that the next time we have a team challenge, I would be excited to try to use Aeroplan again to plan something interesting. But I think the key issues, like I said, are the dynamic prices and the just lack of award availability, particularly for the partner from the partners based in Asia. I think it's been really hard to find awards to Asia for a while now, and that's tough.
Yeah, that's been the challenge. I've been trying to find an award essentially that would allow us to do the stopover in Europe and then fly onward to Asia. It doesn't matter in Asia except we've got the limitation that we can't go to China. Long story, everybody probably knows all the different reasons that could be. And it has just been so challenging to try to piece something together. The I feel like, I don't know, like maybe I'm looking the wrong way, or there just really isn't the space. And I know in past years, it really hasn't been the space, right? Like China, or not China, but Asia was really the slowest to come back from the pandemic. And it still feels like the demand is high and the capacity just is fairly low.
Yeah, you know, for that particular type of redemption, the one thing that I have found, although not as much lately as before, was Condor through Alaska, because, you know, Alaska, book Condor, and they've got the flight from Frankfurt to Bangkok. And I found many days when I looked far in advance where I was able to find four seats, both on the JFK to Frankfurt and Frankfurt to Bangkok. And with the stopover, that's only, 75,000 points one way per passenger, which is a fantastic value for both legs.
So Alaska will let you do a stopover? I didn't realize that they'll let you do a stopover on Condor. I thought I had called and
I think even on
maybe
one way.
Yeah, in a one way. Yeah, I have it booked, and we changed plans. So I'll have to coordinate with you and see if I release seats if you can pick them up if they work.
Yeah, if you do, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. But yeah, I booked it. So I booked JFK to Frankfurt with a stopover for, I don't know, a week or maybe a little more. I can't recall. And then the onward leg to Bangkok. And I was able to do that right on the Alaska Airlines website with their stopover tool and 75,000 points per passenger, which is a great deal because just the JFK to Frankfurt would be 55,000 miles one way. So for an additional 20,000, you can continue on to Bangkok, which seemed to me to be enough of a deal that I said, oh, you know what? We've got to book that.
For
and
sure.
I booked it. And then we changed plans a little bit. So as one does.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's exactly, you know, the sort of thing that I've been trying to figure out. And I think I've been banging my head against the wall. So really appreciate you sharing that. What award tools have you been enjoying lately?
So I use a few things very regularly. I use a award tool, in fact, all the time. It's a flight search tool, and that's the one I use maybe second most frequently, I would say, somewhere between number one and number two. I use award tool specifically because I like to widen the net with different airports. I happen to be based in kind of the middle of nowhere in upstate New York, where the New York airports are around 3 hours from me, but Boston is only maybe 3.5. And I could even get a short flight to DC to position out of DC, or Philadelphia is maybe 4.5 hours. So there's enough different options that I'm willing to consider, because no matter what, it's going to be a little bit inconvenient. So I can deal with different degrees of inconvenience for that. So I like to be able to either put in a whole bunch of airports on this end and then one airport on the other end, or sometimes a little bit of both. Like I'll say, okay, well, I want to look from JFK, Newark, Boston, because I don't mind flying out of any of the three of those. But then on the European side, let me search and see if I can find an award to Frankfurt or Zurich or Brussels or here or there. And I can customize which sides I want to be flexible on and do a pretty wide search. So I enjoy award tool a lot. I think it's really useful for that. I still use Seats.Aero a lot because Seats.Aero is a great way to find specific things when you know what you're looking for. It's not a tool I usually recommend to beginners, but it's a tool that's really helpful for specific stuff. I have a lot of SAS miles because I did the SAS Eurobonus Millionaire Challenge, where we earned 1 million SAS miles by flying on their different SkyTeam partners when they ran that promotion. And SAS tends to release award availability within a couple of months of departure. And so I find it much faster to be able to go to Seats.Aero and see, okay, how far out do they have awards right now, and which cities do they have four seats from the United States? So I find that to be really useful for those types of situations. So those are two tools that I use quite a bit for searching for awards. The one that I might say is the one I use the most is the PointsPath extension, because PointsPath just plugs right into Chrome. It's a Google extension. And so anytime I'm looking at Google flights, I'm comparing side by side against award prices. And I don't actually fly tons of paid flights, but I very frequently go to Google Flights and just look at what prices are for particular trips to get an idea. Sometimes just I want to know who flies somewhere. And there's a different tool I use called Flight Connections that helps with that somewhat. But some days I just want to see, okay, well, what are the times? What are the schedules? Which airline do I think I'll want to fly so I can figure out what kind of miles I might want to use? And so Google Flights just ends up being place I go to on a daily basis. And because PointsPath is just plugged into Chrome and it's showing the prices right there, then I get a good first look at award availability. And if you're familiar with airline partnerships and the Sweet Spot Awards, you can often tell, I can see, oh, okay, this particular Delta flight is available via Air France, or it's available actually more commonly, I'll see it's available via Virgin Atlantic. And I'll say, oh, I bet it's also available via Air France. And sometimes that connection is down, so I might not see the Air France pricing through PointsPath, but then I can go to the Air France website and search and find it. Or if it was available to Air France and Virgin Atlantic, maybe it's going to be available to SAS, and I've got these SAS miles. So those are things that I think are particularly useful about PointsPath. So that's one that I'm using all the time. Apart from awards for paid flights, I've also started using something called Autopilot. And so Autopilot is a tool that automatically reprices flights for you. It only works with certain airlines, certain of the major U.S. airlines. But for instance, with United, I have an upcoming trip where I'm going to be flying United. And so I bought my ticket, and then I put my ticket information, my confirmation number into Autopilot and let it track. And if the price drops by $20 or more, they automatically reprice it, get me a United flight credit, and charge me 25% of the difference. So, you know, if the flight dropped $100 in price, they would automatically reprice that. I'd get a $100 United credit, and they charge my credit card $25 for doing that. And then I don't have to do it at all. Now, some people would say, oh, I could do that on my own with Google Flights by tracking prices and rebook on my own. Just recently, I had it happen where I had a flight I didn't put into Autopilot, and I did use Google Flights to track the price, and I got the alert that it dropped in price. And I said, you know what? I got to make sure I go back and rebook that later on. And of course, it just kept getting pushed back. I had other things to do. I was like, oh yeah, I got to rebook that flight. I got to rebook that flight. And then finally, of course, by the time I got to it, the price had gone up and was even more than what I had originally paid. So I was pretty happy recently when I got the email from Autopilot on a different flight that the price had dropped and they had automatically repriced it. I didn't have to do anything more. In my case, it was, I don't know, $25 that I got back in flight credit. They charged my card $7 and I didn't have to spend 2 minutes on it. So that to me was kind of valuable. I think there might be some other tools that do something like that. This is the first one of those I've tried. I wish that I could get that for Southwest award flights. If I could, my life would be complete.
So first of all, that's a great reminder for me, because I just booked something and I have to put it into Autopilot after learning about it from you a few weeks or probably a week or so ago. Actually, that's what led to having you back on the show. So definitely appreciate you sharing that.
Thank you.
So didn't expect to talk about Southwest today, but since you brought it up, what are your thoughts? Have you flown since the assigned seating has started? Any other observations on Southwest? I guess the value proposition nowadays, or lack thereof?
Yeah, well, there's a number of different things there. I mean, start at the end there, start at the value proposition. The value of points is certainly, I think, dropped. I think it's been pretty easy to see, at least in my experience, that I'm getting less value per point in booking award flights. So that's been somewhat of a disappointment. I expected it, saw it coming, but I'm not particularly happy that value has dropped. Now, that's kind of speaking on the whole, because from the beginning, they said that if you're flying at sort of off-peak times when there's less demand, there's going to be opportunities where points are worth more. And I still have seen some of that. But even as somebody who's generally pretty flexible about when we travel, I've for the most part, not been too thrilled with the value per point being offered by Southwest anymore. When I say not too thrilled, I'm still seeing 1.2 cents per point probably, but it's a little less than the 1.3 or 1.4 that I used to see most of the time. So that's been a little bit of a downer. The new assigned seating thing, I did just recently fly under the new assigned seating policies and the new policies in general. And I think if you have a Southwest credit card, not a lot has changed because you'll still get your free checked bag and you'll still get decent boarding position. So in many ways, it's not a terrible change. And in fact, if you're a cardholder, you're going to get to pick your seat. So in some ways, that might even be better than having to remember to check in 24 hours in advance, because now you can pick where you're going to sit. And if you're a cardholder, you could book a basic economy ticket if you want now and still have your seat selection based on being a cardholder. So I think that probably is an improvement for a lot of people. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to think about checking in 24 hours in advance. You don't have to jostle for position at the boarding gate and make sure you're there on time because you know which seat you're going to have before you get on the plane. So I think that's probably positive for a lot of people. And my wife and I right now both have the sort of premium card. She's got the consumer version, the Southwest Priority card. I got the business version, the Southwest Performance Business card. So both of us get extra legroom seating within 48 hours of departure. And I've booked a number of flights and actually checked into a number that we didn't even end up being able to take for one reason or another. That's another story for another day. But what I want to say about it is that we have been able to get the extra legroom seats 48 hours prior to departure in most instances. So that's been a pleasant surprise. I've been happy with that. But the flip side is that the IT, unsurprisingly, is not ironclad. It doesn't seem to work as well as I may have hoped. And
surprise,
and to give
surprise.
An example. Yeah, right. I mean, there has not ever been Southwest's strong suit. And so we had a flight recently where, to give you the shortest possible version of the story, at 24 hours prior to the flight taking off, I was trying to do some seat selection. And so at that point, my wife and I, as top-tier cardholders, should have had access to any seat on the plane, because at booking, we get access to either standard or preferred seats, and then within 48 hours, we get access to the extra legroom. So we should have been able to pick any seat we wanted on the plane, and we had already, before that point, had selected extra legroom seats. But you can always change your seat later on. So we had our seats, but I had my 8-year-old son got added to the reservation at the last minute. And because he's my wife's companion, she's a companion pass holder, he gets access to her benefits. So he could pick any standard or preferred seat, or if it was available, an extra legroom seat. But what was really weird was that when I logged into his reservation, he had access to seats that my wife and I could not see, you know, as available. And unfortunately, because it was a very full flight and we were adding him at the last minute, the seats near us were not available. So there was it was row 7 that he had been seated in, and there was an aisle and middle seat available. So all I wanted to do was move my seat to sit next to him so he wouldn't be by himself. But I couldn't, because I couldn't see the seat available. And it wasn't the only one. He had access to 5 or 6 seats that he could pick from, and I couldn't see any of them available. I didn't see any seats available on the flight. My wife, when I logged into her reservation, she saw one middle seat in row 16 that was still available, but that was it. That's all that showed available. But when I logged in via his PNR, his confirmation number, there were like 6 seats that were available that, again, as premium cardholders, my wife and I should have been able to see any seat on the plane that was available, but we couldn't. Yeah. So very bizarre, weird, odd, and it all got worked out in the end on the plane when we boarded. But unfortunately, that's annoying, because forget about the disorganization, how my son got added to the reservation last minute and all that. Just imagine you were a premium cardholder on that flight. There's no way that my 8-year-old son should have had access to seats that you can't pick. Like, that's just not how it's supposed to work. So that bit of IT, that bothers me, because in the future, I want to know that being a performance business card holder or a priority card holder is going to give me the best access to seats. And that stole the confidence that I have that that's the case. And so that takes away some of the value of the credit card, in my opinion. Now, I mean,
absolutely.
That said, it was a peak time and then the flight was full and all the other flights we've had so far, we've been able to get our extra legroom seats. It's all worked out pretty well. So overall, I'm pretty happy. I'm annoyed at the poor tech in that regard. So that's kind of the downer. That said, my wife has a companion pass, and on my next statement, I'll earn the companion pass. So we're going to have two companion passes. So there's going to be lots of Southwest travel in my future for the next couple of years. So it's not like I'm turning away from Southwest anytime soon. In fact, if anything, we're leaning into it because we're going to have the two companion passes, which makes it a pretty terrific deal and oftentimes the best award deal possible for us. So I'll be flying plenty of Southwest, but I'll be cautiously, I'm not even going to say optimistic, but cautious about my enthusiasm for Southwest for a while.
Well, when you get that second companion pass, you're going to have to compare the two, the two kids,
right?
See who views which, who sees what seats.
That's so true. I'm very curious to see how that shakes out once we do, because they did see different seats. And the odd thing, if we, you know, to dig into the detail a little bit, my 5-year-old son was booked under a completely separate PNR as an unaccompanied minor. And so his reservation got tied to my wife's reservation, even though it was not, he's not her companion, but it was like the person accompanying him. And he was still able to get the extra legroom seat benefit, my wife's extra legroom seat benefit. When I called Southwest, they said, oh, yeah, because his reservation, even though he had a separate PNR, his reservation is tied. He gets the cardholder benefit and gets the extra legroom seats for free, which was unexpected. I thought, oh, that's kind of cool that that still worked. I thought I'd have to pay for his extra legroom seat, and that I did not think that he would see or he would see a seat A that I couldn't see, because under his PNR, there was one that he saw that I couldn't see. And then, of course, like I said, my 8-year-old shouldn't have seen the 6 seats that he did. But you know, Southwest will probably improve over time. Might be slow, but and most of the time, things are going to be smooth. In our case, that particular flight, we had 4 people on 4 separate reservations, which is not ideal. So there was some aspect of that that was just an unideal situation, but it was sort of an eye opener for me. Just like I said, from the perspective of being a premium cardholder, I would expect to have the best seat selection based on the way the benefits are written. And so hopefully they get that part of it fixed, because that's really the concern, I think, out of that, is that that shouldn't have been the case. But overall, I think Southwest will continue to be Southwest. I think it's not the experience it was that I once loved as much as many people out there did. It's definitely more like other airlines now. And also, unlike other airlines, it was noticeable to me, having flown a lot of JetBlue last year, that there was no seat back entertainment and there were no power outlets. So I think that when they made it more similar to other airlines, it made me notice those dissimilarities a little bit more. Those things that I had kind of overlooked before as just part of Southwest, now I was like, well, but this is like flying anybody, so it should be like flying anybody. And so, you know, I think that they need to make some improvements there, though the free Wi-Fi is, I think, a big boost that everybody seems to be going towards now, and that's nice. So so overall,
that's a trend I can embrace.
Southwest person. Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
So kind of Southwest without the soul. So, yes. So Nick, you said something, and we had a little bit of a section in the notes. We'll kind of jump around if we can. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you had 4 people on 4 different PNRs, and you mentioned that that your 5-year-old, you had him on as an unaccompanied minor. Have you done that like frequently? Are there any extra hoops that you have to jump through? In my mind, I'm thinking about it because, like, in some cases, I can find 2 seats, and then maybe I'm hoping for 1 more seat. Usually, what I'll do is I'll put my wife and my daughter, and then I'll just sort of hope for myself. But I'm just curious if, like, I had to do it all 3 different PNRs. How much of a hoop is it to try to, you know, get all that booked without do you have to call any other major steps?
You know, I assumed it would be really difficult to do and that I'd have to call. And so I had never even considered doing it the way that you just described. until we found ourselves in a situation where, yeah, that was exactly it. There were two seats available initially, and so I needed to scoop those up, and then a third seat came available, and so I had to scoop that up, and then finally the fourth seat became available the day before departure. And so that's how we ended up with four separate. And so I assumed it was going to be a rigmarole and that I would have to call in order to book a seat for my five-year-old, because I started out booking for the adults. I don't remember why I did it that way. I can't remember all the details right now, but there was a reason why I did it that way, I know, at the time. But I was very pleasantly surprised that despite Southwest's generally poor IT, it was easy to do online myself. I didn't have to call anybody. So I went to make the reservation. I just wanted to see what would happen. And I figured it would tell me I can't do that because he's only 5 years old. But when I got through to a certain point in the booking stage, it said this person's, you know, only 5 years old. Is there an adult traveling with them on the same itinerary? And, you know, I clicked the yes, there is. And so then it prompted me to enter the adult's confirmation number and name. And so that's all I had to do was enter my wife's confirmation number and name. And then it took care of it and associated those reservations together. And then when I pulled up my wife's reservation, it has a section in there where it says associated reservations, and it listed his confirmation number. And eventually, when I added my other son as her companion, because she's the companion pass holder, then his confirmation number showed up in that same section under the reservation online. So I don't have experience doing that with other airlines. I haven't run into the need to do that yet with other airlines. Usually, like you said, it's something where, like, I'll book my wife and a son. If I'm going to do two seats, like that type of situation, I would book my wife and a son first and then add myself and the other son later on, kind of a thing if it opened up. This is the first time I've had to book one this way, and it worked out. So it surprised me, but it tells me that if Southwest has a way to handle that, I bet the legacy carriers probably have that tech figured out already. So it's probably simpler than I expected it would be on most airlines.
So we've covered an area where the tech is bad in Southwest and one where they've kind of surprised us, huh?
There should be like some sort of like really long German word for that, you know, when you like get pleasure from IT, you know, it should be like, you know, there should just be some huge multisyllabic word for that in German, I think. But, and maybe there is. I just don't know what it is.
There has to be. It's probably like a sentence long, just one word.
Yeah, like Farfignugen or something, you know.
So Nick, a little bit more on the family travel. I think last time you were on, you had said that you were going to try a little bit of homeschooling and sort of like homeschool while traveling. Can you share just a little update on how that experience has been and any kind of highlights or anything on that you want to share?
Yeah. So yes, we did pursue that. Now, I probably talked about before that I had always assumed that homeschooling was an all or nothing, that you homeschool for the entire year at least, or not at all. But what I had been surprised to learn as we got to know some folks who homeschool, it doesn't have to be that way. You can homeschool for just part of a school year. And so the rules are going to differ a little bit from one state to another, I imagine. And it may be more difficult if you live in a large city where school placement and all the rest of that is more of a challenge. I live in a very small town where there's one school. In fact, there's one class for each grade. So it's a very, very small town. So there's not a second teacher for any of the grades. So it's not like there was going to be a problem coming back. So what we did was we took the kids out and homeschooled for a quarter. So at the start of the second quarter, we took the kids out of school and we homeschooled from the first week of November until mid-January, about the time the second quarter ended. And so it was 2.5 months-ish or so of homeschooling. And it was actually very good by many measures. It was surprisingly easy to do. I am under the impression that my state, New York State, in general, has some of the more stringent educational standards. And I don't know if that's true or it's just a bias. I've always been under the impression that was the case because of the Regents exams that we do and the requirement for teachers to get a master's degree, et cetera, et cetera. It surprised me how little requirement there is to be able to homeschool. There was very little required from us in terms of not to be able to homeschool, but I mean, actually, in terms of what you have to submit, it was very simple to submit a plan. It does not require as much detail as you would imagine it to. You need to have some general idea of the different topics that you intend to cover, but it's literally a one-page document that explains what you're going to do. So it's not something I assumed that we would need to submit like a binder full of materials that we were going to pursue during the time and some detailed lesson planning and that sort of thing. None of that was the case. It was actually remarkably simple in terms of you can get a template online for what it is you have to write up and explain. And so once we knew how to do that, my wife did it, and it probably took her 20 minutes, maybe, to fill out the entire, you know, plan for what we were going to try to accomplish. And so we were also additionally very lucky that our kids' teachers were incredibly supportive. They thought it was a great opportunity to take the kids out and travel and homeschool. And so they were incredibly helpful in terms of supplying us with some of the materials and ideas and things that they were going to be doing in school. We had bought books and things like that that we were going to do, but then they gave us some of their materials that they were going to be using in class. And so that helped us because our main concern, now our kids are young, so the material that they're working on right now is not difficult. You know, we're doing very simple math and reading and things like that. So it wasn't stuff that we thought we couldn't do. My concern, though, was that if we don't do the same stuff that they're doing in school, then when they go back to school, they're going to be behind their classmates or be missing things that everybody else has. So I wanted to make sure that we were kind of keeping them up to date with the things they were that their classmates were going to be doing at home. And so it was very helpful that their teachers were super supportive of that. And I think we were just lucky in many regards in that way. But we didn't get any pushback. School was great about it. The teachers were great about it in terms of giving us some support for that. So the hardest part was just making the time to do it. You know, of course, that's something that is somewhat of a challenge when you're on the move all the time. And traveling is kind of the opposite of a routine. And so when you take away the entire structure or semblance of a routine, and then you're like, oh, yeah, but we also need this schoolwork routine, that can be a little challenging, I think, if you're not disciplined about it. And particularly kids vary. You know, like my two kids, I have one kid who's very sort of studious and very interested in learning and very open to, okay, let's sit down and do some work out of the book. And one kid who is less inclined to sit down and do the schoolwork when it's time to do the schoolwork. So I think it's going to vary. Your success rate is going to vary based on the kids a little bit. And of course, your own personality and your own connection. But I would tell you, I wouldn't trade anything for it, because the memories that I think we will have as a family in the long run, whether or not we raise good human beings, which I certainly hope we do, but it's always hard to predict, right? So I don't know whether the travel is going to influence that, but I think it'll really influence the bond that we have. And that, to me, is really worth it, because the things that we're able to talk about and memories we're able to share are, to me, pretty amazing, pretty fascinating, and pretty unique. And I'm always really surprised by the things my kids remember from our trips. And it's not that you go to a museum and they soak up everything and absorb every factoid and can recite all the information. It's more, to me, the surprise, like 6 or 8 months later, or a year later, when we see something and they say, oh, it's like, and they relate it to a memory from one of our trips. And to me, that's really valuable. Being able to relate things in the world in general is, to me, a valuable skill. So I think it was absolutely worthwhile. It went pretty well. There was very little paperwork to be done. The process was super simple. So that's going to probably, again, vary based on your school. Some schools will be probably less helpful. We were very fortunate. The school is under no requirement or obligation to really give you any assistance. But the school, even in our small school, had a homeschool liaison, a person whose job is to handle or That's help cool. handle that process for people. So it was easier than I expected.
How
it
cool
to
is
be.
That? That's awesome. Where'd you go?
So, yeah, didn't even talk about that, did I? So we did a mixture of things. So we started out in the Bahamas because I had had Caesar's Diamond status in the past. And so I had a free 4-night stay at Atlantis. And so that to me was just kind of a fun kickoff, was the idea, oh, we'll go sit on the beach and do the water slides for a few days. And we did do those things, but I was really pleasantly surprised. They have a great aquarium at Atlantis. And so we spent a good amount of time one day going around and talking to the kids about the different things in the ocean. And you know, some of them my wife and I have seen before. And so we talked about other places they lived and blah, blah, blah. It turned out to be far more educational than I expected that aspect of the trip to be. Now, I mean, don't get me wrong. Like I said, we did also spend time on the beach and on the water slides and all the rest of those fun things, but it was nice to be able to mix in some of the educational aspect as well. And then from there, we went to Los Angeles. My kids do some educational apps like ABC Mouse and Homer they've done before, and some others like that, Beast Academy for Math, etc. And in one of the educational apps, there is a unit about the La Brea Tar Pits in Los Angeles, which is something I had personally not been familiar with until my kids told me all about it.
I'm aware of them. I still haven't been there.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a place that I ever had on my list, but my kids kept asking. They kept saying, can we go to the La Brea Tar Pits? Can we go to the La Brea Tar Pits? Because they really enjoyed this unit that they actually chose to do again and again and again in this one app. And we've been trying to lean into those things and say, well, yeah, let's try and plan a trip around that. So we wanted to go to the South Pacific, but we said, okay, well, we can find flight availability from Los Angeles. Let's go to Los Angeles for a couple of days and we'll go see the La Brea Tar Pits. So that's what we did. We flew from the Bahamas to Los Angeles. And we went to see the La Brea Tar Pits, and the kids were fascinated by that and the displays in the museum there. You can see just hundreds of direwolf skulls. We learned about lots of animals. And in fact, every time that the trip has come up, I think my kids have told whoever it is that asks about the La Brea Tar Pits and about a few of the animals they learned about. Yesterday's camel. Did you know camels lived in Los Angeles long ago? Literally called yesterday's camel. Not an animal that I knew existed. There was a North American lion. Again, something I never knew existed. And my kids, they held on to that. They really latched on to those things, and they can name a whole bunch of the different animals that were found in the La Brea Tar Pits. That you know, there was a bunch of really fascinating stuff. The museum was pretty cool there. So I wouldn't necessarily plan an entire trip to Los Angeles just to go to that. But if you've got kids and you're going to Los Angeles, I think it's totally worth going to visit. So, yeah, we enjoyed that. That was a lot of fun. Kids still talk about that. And then we flew off to French Polynesia. And so we spent some time in Bora Bora and Moorea. And yes, as one does. but that was great too, because we saw a lot more sea life. And so we talked about a lot of things in the aquarium, and we saw a lot of stuff, some stingrays by the Hilton on Moorea. There's a little beach just off to the side of the hotel where there's some houses and some locals live. And we saw a kid playing in the water and realized he was playing with a stingray. And it was just swimming all around him and playing, and we kind of wandered over, and before you knew it, we were all in the water, and the stingray was just coming up right by us. And you know, it was very, very friendly.
When in Rome, right?
Yeah. Right, when in Rome, why not? So so we got to have some of those experiences and that sort of thing. So we spent some time there, then back for Thanksgiving, and then off to Europe for Christmas markets. So in Europe, we went to the Christmas markets in Strasbourg, France, and Cologne,
something
Germany.
Trevor loves.
Yes. Oh, well, for good reason, right? What's your favorite of the Christmas markets?
You know, I like Mainz. Mainz is just like a small little, because it's the smaller city. I mean, we've done Berlin, we've done Paris, we've done Vienna, and I think Budapest and Bratislava and Prague. But Mainz just had a more jovial feel. It had like a more warmth to it, I felt like. Maybe I don't know, that was my experience, and so I need to get back there, because they've got that great Hyatt Regency just like a short walk from the where they do the markets, and it's just such a cool little city, like, because you can walk along the Rhine, and you know, you've just got it's a romantic city to me. So yeah, I like Mainz. What was your favorite?
Well, you know, that's interesting because we love Strasbourg, France. I think Strasbourg was the best we've been to so far. Wonderful. They call themselves the capital of Christmas, and for good reason. They're not being arrogant. It's quite well done. So city's very well decorated and everything. But it piqued my interest that you said Mainz, because that was something I had floated, was the idea of stopping there for a night on the way back, because we were flying back to the United States from Frankfurt and taking the train. And so that was a place that we could have stopped for the night. And I looked it up a little bit and I said, oh, you know what, that actually looks like it would be pretty cute. And I pitched that, and eventually we decided we weren't going to do that. Now I regret it, and I will bring that up when we when we next talk about Christmas market plans, because
it's not going anywhere. That was one still there.
Yeah, so well, that's true. And that's the nice thing with miles and points, right? We can always get back there again. And in fact, the other place we went on that segment of the trip was to northern Finland. There's a Santa Claus holiday village that we went to a few years ago in Rovaniemi in Lapland, Finland. And we decided that we wanted to do that one more time while the kids are still young, and that still feels really magical for them. And so we went there again. And the previous time we had gone and brought my wife's sister with us, and she had a great time. And we really thought that my wife's mother would love this too. And so this time we brought her. And so she came along with and did all the Christmas markets and got to go to the Santa Claus village. And I think that that's become a really special thing for us. We've gotten more and more family involved in coming on some of those trips and building some of those memories. And those are things that, you know, I didn't take trips with my grandparents as a kid, and I didn't have the same relationship with them that my kids do. And my kids have a great relationship with them for a lot of reasons, but the trips that we take, they build memories that, again, those are things that they're always going to have, you know, the memories that they have of our family being with us.
I couldn't agree
on some
more
of those wild trips.
You know, I'm actually embarking on one tomorrow. We've got a nice multi-generational trip on a cruise. I know it might be a little segue, because that's something that you and I probably both appreciate. I was curious to pick your brain about anything lately, you know, anything on the deal side or anything that you've really had a great experience with cruising. Because I, you know, that's something that I've been pivoting a lot of my travel, just because I just find so much value in cruising and kind of enjoy the experience, especially when you're talking about exactly what you're talking about, family, multi-generational trips. And it just, you're right, it's just like amping the memory making when you have some of those type of things combined.
Yeah, for sure. I think that cruising has worked out really well for that, actually. And we were not interested necessarily in cruising until the opportunity came up to do it with various casino matches and that whole set of shenanigans that happened with different matching opportunities for a while.
Well, the great opportunities that were out there, you know, that people that were just there for the grabbing, you know?
They were. And the first one, I said, you know what, this is too good of a deal to pass up. We've got to try this out. And we fully expected to not enjoy it. But I thought, you know what, it's too good of a deal to pass up. We'll get to spend time. And in that case, we were booking a cruise in Europe and said, we'll get to spend time in a bunch of European cities. So we know we'll enjoy that part of it anyway. We'll probably hate the cruise, and I'll write about how I hated it, and that's good enough, and we'll be done with it. And and so I thought that that was going to be it. And that turned into like 13 or 14 cruises or something over the course of like 3 years. So
as it does, you know,
yes, as it does. So obviously we didn't end up hating it. We ended up enjoying it. And I think, like you said, it is so perfect for the multi-generational trips. We've had several cruises now where a number of family members have joined us on the cruise. And it's a great way for everybody to be able to get out there and enjoy the things they want to enjoy and still have different options for everybody when you get back on board. And it's relatively simple. Your hotel floats along with you and takes you to different places, so you can explore. Yes. I particularly like it in Europe. You can explore 5, 6, 8, 10 different places over the course of a week or two and not have to unpack and repack. That to me is awesome. But yeah, so there are still opportunities. It's not quite the same as it was before, but if you did any of the other matching opportunities, there are still match opportunities that continue to come around. Norwegian had one recently, and so we were able to submit some of our other offers and get a free cruise offer from Norwegian. So we have a cruise booked with them in Europe later on this year. that we were able to do thanks to matching an old offer from another cruise line. And we did the same thing with Margaritaville at Sea. I just looked up the email address for their Players Club and sent an email and said, hey, listen, I've had these other free offers. Here are some. Sent some screenshots of some of the free offers I'd gotten from other cruise lines. And sure enough, they gave me an offer for a free balcony cruise on Margaritaville at Sea, which is a line that only has two ships, and probably people who are familiar with it think of it as a very budget sort of a cruise line, and it can be that way. However, we took that and we were really pleasantly surprised. First of all, I was shocked that they let me book a cruise over New Year's Eve. I thought that the free cruise offer, there's no way they're going to let me do the New Year's Eve cruise, right? But I said, you know, those are the most convenient dates. It'd be after the Christmas markets and everything. So yeah, I booked a cruise that took off on December 30th and went through New Year's Eve. And it, again, it was just the taxes, so a few hundred dollars for the taxes. And we had a blast on Margaritaville at Sea. I would absolutely consider cruising with them again. I think I'd be excited about another cruise with Margaritaville at Sea. I think with kids,
That's high praise.
Yeah, really. So it doesn't have the bells and whistles. If you primarily want to go on a cruise for a ship that's got zip lines and go-karts and water slides, Margaritaville at Sea is not for you. Like that,
it's not your one, yeah.
It's not that at all. Like, so it's very far from that. And in our case, most of the cruises we've picked with these free cruise offers, we've mostly picked cruises that go to places we want to go, prioritizing the destinations rather than prioritizing the ship, which has meant that we've ended up with a lot of subpar ships and not cared very much about that because they've been going to the places that we wanted to go to and the ship itself was good enough and, you know, we enjoyed it well enough. So I don't have the bias of being biased towards those higher, you know, sort of higher level experiences on ships if you're into those types of amenities. So I was not disappointed in Margaritaville at Sea from that standpoint. And on the flip side, I was really impressed with how welcoming it was from a family standpoint. I pictured sort of a booze cruise atmosphere where everybody was there for a party.
It has the word margarita
in the name of the cruise. How can that possibly be appropriate for kids, right? But much to my surprise, that was not the case at all. It was very much, and it made sense later on. I was like, you know what? I have an image of folks who like Jimmy Buffett as being pretty friendly people, right? I mean, like, you know, the whole parrot head idea, it's a pretty friendly crowd. And sure enough, that was it. It was much more like a family barbecue, I felt like, than a wild and crazy party atmosphere. It was more like a, come on, the kids are fine. Bring them on over. You know, they're not bothering anybody. Let them have fun. Let them be a kid. And let's all have a good time together with very low, pressure to kind of stay in line or not as much. There were no formal nights. You didn't have to dress up for dinner. You could be comfortable as sort of a come as you are type of a situation. And to me, that was super comfortable traveling with a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. That's actually kind of what I want. And what I need, you know, I want a casual dinner. I don't want to have spend an hour getting everybody ready in the cabin before we go to dinner. So I actually really liked that. We enjoyed it. We had a lot of fun. I thought that the entertainment was fun. It was decent. They had a crew talent show, which probably saved them a lot of money on paying for a show. But like, as somebody who's been on a lot of cruise ships, it was kind of cool to me to see, this waiter who I've seen in the dining room every night, he can sing, you know? And so I thought that was a fun way that they did, you know, from one perspective, you could say they really cheaped out on entertainment that night because it didn't cost them very much to do. But on the other end, it was kind of fun. They also had a singing competition from a karaoke competition, if you will, of guests. And so they had karaoke nights throughout. And then one night that was the show in the theater was the best of the guest karaoke. And so again, these were people, there was a guy I was playing poker with each night at the poker table in the casino who I had no idea could sing Don't Stop Believin' by Journey, but my goodness, did he tear it up on that stage. And I was like, I know that guy. I've seen him at the table each day. Wow, I had no idea. And so to me, that was fun. And I could totally see where some people would say that they would rather have the whole show production. And I get that. And if that's what you want, again, Margaritaville at Sea is not necessarily for you. They did have some production shows, by the way. It wasn't only that type of entertainment. But to me, I found that refreshing and fun and different than what I've seen on other cruise lines. And so I think we enjoyed it from that perspective. So that's one that if you have had the other offers from other cruise lines, I would totally try and submit to their Players Club. You can just Google the email address for their Players Club. They're putting a new ship in service, I think, later this year. So they're going to have three ships. So I would bet there's going to be some capacity for free cruises with them. So worth it.
And I think your strategy is definitely what I've heard of, which was new to me a little while ago, which is the idea of being your own casino host, you know, because there's lots of other services that will try to do this. You know, you take their offers to them and they'll kind of shop you around to different casinos to try to get offers for you. But you can do that yourself. You can literally call them to, hey, this is, you know, I have offers. I have other casinos have offered me complimentary cruises. Here's examples of what they've given me. What can you offer me? You know, and it does seem like many cruise lines, not just Margaritaville, but I think several cruise lines will do that and offer you. I have not tried it myself, but I've heard lots of different, you clearly have a data point. I've heard of other successful data points. So, but it's an interesting one, especially something, you know, if you want to give it a shot. I mean, nothing, unlike in the casino, you know, you don't wager anything, you don't lose anything, you know?
Right, for sure.
I'm literally pulling up Margaritaville at Sea as you guys are talking about that. Sorry.
As you should be, as you know, and yes, from a loyalty program standpoint type of a thing, their program is actually somewhat interesting too, in that reaching the first tier or two of status, it was not terribly difficult to do. They had I can't remember the exact numbers right now, but they had a certain number of points that you could either earn over the course of a year or a certain number you could earn in a single day. And either way, you would end up getting status. And so I was pretty surprised because the status at the different levels, I mean, it comes with a free cruise with a very reasonable amount of play. If you're a gambler at all, it doesn't require a lot of gambling to get the level of status that'll get you a free cruise each year. And then, you know, you could also, there was a level you get a free birthday cruise and one where you could get a cruise you could give to somebody else, which I was like, give to somebody else? Like, they want the gambler on board, don't they? So I was pretty surprised.
They might have gotten that part wrong.
Hey, don't tell them. All right. Keep that between us.
But you know, you bring up one good point, which is, you know, I find, and I've said this before, is that, you know, when you are a casino customer, you know, at sea, it seems like the return to player in terms of like what kind of complimentary things the player can receive seems so much more generous than what you would do on land, you know, because I think if you were going into a Las Vegas casino and you were to gamble, I don't know, you know, you had a gambling budget of $1,000 a day or something like that. To them, you're nothing. You know, $1,000 to them is, you know, what I don't even know what that is. It's like what they spend on toilet paper or it's really not something that they're spending a lot of time courting you as a customer. You know, they might, oh, we can offer you a free night at the Excalibur on Tuesday. You know, that's right, about, right. You know, what they can offer you. Whereas, you know, I think if you had that kind of a budget on a cruise ship and you were, you know, kind of willing to wager that much money, you know, on a daily basis, I think that you would very easily get a complimentary cruise. And there's a lot of different options. And the other thing is, I think the cruise lines also have a lot of distressed inventory, probably even more so than Vegas. And they've got, you know, shorter cruises, 3-night cruises, 4-night cruises, or cruises that, you know, are not anywhere close to being sold out, that they're happy to throw as a marketing expense at somebody who potentially could, you know, be somebody who actually gambles a fair amount for them. So they're willing to give people tries and try to court new customers to the casino, because I really do think casinos are probably a pretty large profit center for them, you know, and is definitely part of their business plan. I mean, there's a reason why you find them on most mainstream cruise lines, because clearly they're, and if anything, you see cruise lines expanding the sizes of the casinos. They're becoming a larger portion of the floor plan than they were in the past. So I think they probably find it fairly profitable and is a good profit center. So, you know, it's something to look at. And I think we're still in this phase where the casinos seem to be fairly generous. I worry that at some point they're going to reel it back. But for the most part, I think cruise lines seem to be rewarding, at least in my opinion, providing a lot of value to people who at least do a modicum of gambling. I think you can be a low stakes gambler and still get something reasonably good from these cruise lines. And that's hard to do, I think, in land. I think if you want to go to Vegas and be treated to a lot of free food, get a brand new suite, you know, get picked up from the airport. I mean, you need to be gambling a lot of money, you know, at most casinos for them to take notice, because people do gamble large sums of money at these land-based casinos. And I feel like the stakes in a cruise line based casino just tend to be a little bit lower, you know, and the type of customer tends to have a lower threshold for what they're wagering on a regular basis. I mean, you have some people who do a lot of gambling, but I mean, you also have a lot of casual gamblers.
Right. You have many fewer of those whales that you're competing with on a cruise ship than in a major casino, you know, and like you said, I think there's a perfect example that, you know, if you had $1,000 a day gambling budget, which, I mean, if that sounds crazy to you, fine. There's nothing wrong with thinking that's crazy. There's also nothing wrong with being somebody who has $1,000 a day gambling budget, but you're absolutely right. That's not going to move the needle at all in a land casino in Las Vegas. But on a cruise ship, the incremental cost of keeping you on board each day for one additional guest for a room that they may not have sold is probably really low on a cruise ship. And so their upside on getting you on board if you're that type of gambler.
The economics make sense.
Yeah. It's a totally different scheme of things, or a totally different play. So yeah, I agree 100%.
And your captive audience, you know, once you're on the cruise ship, true. It's not like you're going to gamble at another casino.
Right. Right.
I'm just going to go to the next door.
Yeah. Right, right. No, that's absolutely true. It's a great observation. And I think it's true for people who like to gamble, but don't want to do it at the high stakes necessary to get impressive comps in Las Vegas or wherever your land-based casino choice is. I think that's a great observation, that a cruise is a great way to get tons of value, because the cruise itself, like the free cruise, that has a lot of potential value depending on how you use it to you as the customer, right? And, you know, if you value that experience and you want to go to the places that the cruise ship is going to take you to, and you like the food and the entertainment, all the rest of those things, like, I think there's tons of potential value to the consumer.
Yes.
Relatively low cost to the cruise line. And like you said, captive audience, a lot of upside for the cruise line. So yeah, absolutely worth pursuing that if you're a small mid-stakes gambler.
So before we leave the high seas over high stakes, I have to ask Nick, we know that on Royal Caribbean, for example, you can load from your CPass account, and that's essentially a way to increase your organic spend. What was your experience on Margaritaville at Sea? Was it the same kind of construct, or are you bringing cash with you?
No, yeah, you don't need to. It is. It's actually even easier, or maybe not, depending on your level of comfort with a human being. But Margaritaville at Sea, you didn't load to your card the way you do on most casinos. Instead, it was very similar to what you would expect to be like a cash advance experience. You had to go to the cage and hand over your credit card so they could run it, and then they would just give you the cash, and it coded as a purchase.
Wow.
So there was no need to even have it in the machine. It was just literally, I'd like to take out $1,000, and they just tap your card and give you the $1,000 for it, which was pretty
surprising. And no fee for doing that?
No fee. Yeah.
Wow. No. That is another potential reason to go on a Margaritaville at Sea cruise.
Already got it open. I was surprised. Yes.
What are you available?
I got to say.
It wasn't the experience I expected. But I'm
glad we're waiting till an hour into this podcast mentioning this. So hopefully it's only the real regular listeners.
Yeah, we'll bury this, right?
I will say, by the way, though, but I used my Altitude Reserve card and it did not code as travel, oddly. A number of readers have reported it coding as dining on Margaritaville at Sea. So,
that could be even better.
Take that and
break out your prestige.
With that, what you will.
Break out my prestige card. Yeah.
Don't shoot the messenger if it doesn't code that way for you.
Yeah.
That's what people have told me it coded at. And sure enough, in my Altitude Reserve statement, it did say dining.
Yeah. So, but I don't know.
Yep. Wow. That's interesting.
Very cool. So, before we close it out, I wanted to kind of do a one bullet lightning round, and then you know sort of just ask your thoughts on another. I think you've talked about that LifeMiles subscription in the past. Still valuable? I feel like I've moved personally from LifeMiles where I mean. Unless it's something, you know, very similar to Etihad, right? If it's something close in that I know I'm not going to change, I'll go LifeMiles. If it's anything else, I just feel like I steer clear. Do you feel like that's, am I shutting things off or unnecessarily, or is LifeMiles still as difficult as it always, or as it used to be?
No, you're absolutely shutting it off and unnecessarily, I'm going to tell you. So LifeMiles is
really
difficult. It's more difficult, there's no doubt, from the standpoint of the award you want to find is not always easy to find, if it's findable at all. And so, you know, that I have to caveat in two different ways, because sometimes an award that should be available just can't be booked through LifeMiles for no reason that anybody can explain or understand. Sometimes it's just a matter of monkeying around with the search tool itself and picking out Star Alliance or the airline you want. Or the other day I was searching in the app and I was able to check some boxes for the airline and the Star Alliance that don't show up as checkable necessarily on the website. I found the app experience to be a little different than the desktop experience. That was new to me. That was just something I ran into the other day. Yeah, I hadn't either. That was the first time I had gotten into it. And I realized I had found recently that I had some difficulty with picking out the airline from the drop down on the website when the airline didn't operate the particular route that I was like, they were just a component in the award, not the only carrier. It gave me some pushback. It wouldn't let me pick dates and things, but on the app, it was easier to get past that roadblock. So it might be worth looking at the app. However, the LifeMiles Plus subscription, here's the thing. There are a few different problems with LifeMiles. One, of course, is what I just mentioned with the difficulty of finding awards. Another is the short expiration. They expire after 12 months of inactivity, which is the shortest I'm aware of any of the major airline programs. Super easy to forget and have your miles expire because you forgot that they were about to expire. So that's a potential danger. So for me, because I had a chunk of LifeMiles, you know, more than 5,000 or 6,000, a decent chunk, not a wild, crazy chunk, but a decent chunk of LifeMiles, it was worth it to me for the peace of mind to pay the $20 a month to know that I was going to keep them alive for the low level LifeMiles Plus and for the 10% discount.
Calendar invites. I know.
Then you run into that situation where I'm dismiss it. Like, oh, I'll do it later, and then I don't do it. And so you're right. No, there's definitely better ways than paying $20 a month to handle that part of it. But that was a side benefit for me anyway, for the lowest level. And
having
I like
just
the 10%.
Transferred 1,000 LifeMiles just to keep my LifeMiles alive for this month. So.
Smart.
My 12 month just, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I could even make it a more regular thing where maybe I'll just make it a first of the month. I transfer in 1,000 miles just to keep them alive and I'll use them eventually. I could do something like that. There's a lot of ways I could solve that don't cost $20 a month. But anyway, I also like the fact that it's a 10% discount on awards. And that includes if you're booking mixed cabin and whatnot, it still drops 10% off of the award price, which is nice. Last piece, though, and the piece that, forget about what I just said about paying the $20 a month forever for the low-level subscription, the $50 a month subscription is the one you need to get free cancellation. And I wondered for a long time whether it would work this way. And then I've had a few readers who confirmed that they booked an award and then realized later on that they wanted to cancel it. So they subscribed to the $50 a month plan and then canceled for free and then later canceled the $50. I think the terms say you have to spend 6 months with the plan that you subscribe to. I'm not sure that that's enforced, but I haven't run into So it would cost you then the $50 a month for the 6 months, though you're getting miles every month. What is it? 2,000 miles a month. So you're getting some of that in value back, not all of it, but some of it. So it's not, the net cost is not as bad as $50 a month initially sounds anyway. So the cancellation penalty does not necessarily have to be as high as it looks. Now, that wouldn't appeal to me as a lone traveler. If I were traveling by myself, that would still seem a little expensive. But for a family of four, for instance, if I have to pay $50 a month for 6 months in order to get a cancellation, that's $300, $75 a piece. That's a pretty typical award cancellation fee for a lot of airlines. So that's an amount I can live with. And that's if I didn't value the 2,000 miles a month that I'm getting with the Life Miles Plus subscription at all. And if I do value that sum, you know, let's say I value those at 1 cent per mile. So over the 6 months, I'm going to get 12,000 miles. That's sort of like $120 back out of that 300. So really $180 net cost to me to get free cancellation for 6 months. That to me is a good deal. So you, again, you don't need to do that before you book the award. You just need to do it before you cancel the award. And so it essentially creates the ability to cancel an award cheaply. So again, if it was for one person, that value might not seem appealing to me. But if you're traveling on an itinerary with multiple people, I think it's actually a relatively low cancellation cost out of the airlines that have cancellation fees. So I think if you play it like that, it can actually work out to be pretty good. And for this summer, for instance, the award that my wife asked me if we could change, we booked business class JFK to Brussels and on Brussels Airlines and then on to Zurich on Swiss Air. And that was 49,000. Is what it came out to at the 10% discount. So with the JFK to Brussels in business and the Brussels to Zurich in economy, I think. So the, you know, we're going to get across the pond for less than 50,000 miles per passenger in business class. I took advantage of a 15% transfer bonus from Capital One. So really only cost us about 44K each for summertime business class travel to Europe. It's a good enough deal that to me, I said, okay, well, yeah, if I have to pay the $50 a month down the road to cancel, I will.
No, that sounds like a great value, and I appreciate that. I feel like sometimes I just look at things that have that high friction, and it just makes me want to say, no, I'm going to go a different way. I will say, selfishly, by the way, I just happened to log into my Life Miles, and my miles will expire at the end of next month. So,
you're welcome.
So this episode's really for me because...
Glad we could solve that for you.
I have to ask, because we're talking subscriptions, Flying Blue now has a subscription as well. And some cases that subscription opens up more additional, I don't know if it's additional space or just additional, the monthly saver, business class awards. The promo awards. Have you explored that, that subscription at all, Nick?
I haven't. So this month was the first time I looked at it because they did announce the promo rewards and specifically announced destinations that were only for the people who subscribed to that. And so there were a few additional destinations. There weren't enough that I would necessarily be compelled to subscribe yet at this point. However, the nice thing is that if they did announce one where there was a city that I wanted to depart out of for a promo reward, then I think you could still just subscribe then and go ahead and book it. So, you know, if New York was on the list, then I might consider paying the 379, I think it is, mm-hmm, 379 euros for the entry-level subscription in order to be able to get access to those promo rewards. Because again, I look at it from the perspective of traveling with a family of four, that's, you know, about $100 each in order to get access to a promo reward that could be a really good price. I think I would hold off on doing it until there's a time when you expect it to make sense. I haven't taken a deep dive into it, so maybe you guys will have some more information, some more things to share there. The one thing about Flying Blue that I really like and keeps me coming back and looking at it, whether it's what we book or not, is that there's a 25% discount for kids ages 2 to 11. So the kids pay 25% less, which drops our net cost for four passengers pretty significantly for transatlantic travel. SAS, Scandinavian airline, is a 50% discount for kids 2 to 11.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's even more incredible. That blew my mind. And that 50% even applies when they occasionally run some sale deals. And when they do, it still applies to that, which is pretty amazing to me. But the child discount also applies to Air France, KLM, Flying Blue's promo rewards. So again, back to the subscription, it's something I would consider if they had my city on the list 1 month only for subscribers, then I might look at that and say for $100 a piece, yeah, I can save
targeted
more than
subscriptions $100
worth of miles.
Is See, it sounds like the theme of the day, targeted subscribing.
Yeah.
Targeted
subscribing. So I will.
I like it.
I will offer one data point because I did put this out to the Mylanomics community, and Rob at 35,000 feet in the Mylanomics community had said that he thought that the same space that you get access to with the subscription was the same that either Platinums or kind of higher tier elites get, which may almost make it a little less exciting to me. Or it seems like a way to get some of the benefits of status without putting in the time or effort or money other than that 379. So I don't, we just don't have enough data points, but I'd probably put it out to our listeners. Definitely weigh in. I think it's definitely something where I know I'm curious. I was tempted to pull the trigger on it. I think it was in January they had DC. Or Dulles as one of those that was behind the subscription paywall. We didn't end up pulling that trigger, but definitely seems like one of those interesting things that hopefully we'll get more insight into.
Yeah, now that you mention it, maybe I'll take a look at exploring, because it might be interesting just from a writing about it standpoint to know what kind of extra availability it does make available beyond, not having the subscription, because that certainly could be appealing. Air France KLM Flying Blue tends to sometimes have really good deals with their standard award pricing, and they for a long time had some awards that maybe weren't the cheapest saver sort of level, but then we're still relatively reasonable. I don't necessarily see that as much now as I once did. I used to see, for instance, it used to be the saver price was like 50K, but you could still find quite a bit at 70 or 80. And so even
60.
Yeah, yeah. And now the saver's at 60. And so sometimes you'll find that. But if you don't, I'm not finding as much in between there and like 105. So I'm using examples to Europe here from the U.S. with Flying Blue.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe if that opens up even some of that in between space, that would be nice. Certainly if it opens up more saver space, more saver routes, that could certainly be appealing. I think that type of thing becomes really appealing for somebody with limited flexibility. If you've got a job where you bid your vacation time far in advance, where you're beholden to the school schedule, you're not going to homeschool like us to kind of get around it and be able to travel whenever the need arises, then I think that a subscription like that has more potential value if it really does work as advertised. Whereas I tend to tailor my trips around, there's four seats available that day. That's when we're going to go to Paris. So it just depends how you approach those things.
Awesome. Awesome. So before we close out, any award charts you're starting to look at that have piqued your interest that we might not have on our radar?
So I have not dug into this yet, but I'm interested in digging in a little bit more with Air India's award chart, because they are a transfer partner of Rove Miles, and I know that I've heard people talking about using them for United redemptions in the United States, but that makes me curious about what other things are out there that maybe we're not considering with that, because it's a program that not very many people have written extensively about in the past. So I'm curious about looking for where else there's value, because a lot of times those programs that haven't partnered with many transferable currencies before have some of those sweet spots that maybe have existed for a long time but have gone largely ignored. Japan Airlines is another example like that, where we wrote last year about how you can book Air France flights without any surcharges through Japan Airlines. If I knew that Japan Airlines partnered with Air France, then it was something I had long ago forgotten about, because it wasn't something that was anywhere near my mind until I started looking at award opportunities using Japan Airlines miles. And of course, I'm bringing that up because now they're a Bilt transfer partner. They're a Capital One transfer partner. We recently saw a great transfer bonus from Bilt, and we've seen a couple of transfer bonuses now from Capital One that are slightly less compelling, but nonetheless there. And now they're a Rove Miles transfer partner. So I think there's a lot more opportunity to get those miles, and maybe that means that we'll see more opportunities in the future. I don't know, but that's another program that I think has a lot of potential value that maybe has gone untapped. And I think that using them for Japan Airlines flights has always been a good value, but might be a lot more competitive now that there's far more people with the currency. But those opportunities like flying Air France are something that a lot of folks probably haven't considered and won't think about. So I think there's a lot of that stuff yet to be found in their award charts. So I'm particularly curious about that. And then last but not least, I had not been as enthusiastic about Citi for lodging as a lot of people have because they have their partnerships with Preferred Hotels and Resorts and leading hotels of the world. And so I just haven't found many opportunities where those hotels have met up with my plans. However, I anticipate that I'm going to use Preferred Hotels this summer. And so I'm excited about that. I was also excited when I got looking for leading hotels of the world that are kid-friendly. There are some amazing looking leading hotels of the world for family travel. And I have not yet had a chance to fully dig into award pricing. But if you Google best family friendly leading hotels of the world, you're going to come across a page on the Leading Hotels of the World site where you look at the places and say, wow, I need to look into those and see which of those are accessible with points because they do look pretty cool. And some of them, I did look at one or two that looked very expensive with cash and so, but likely also very expensive with points, if even available with points. But nonetheless, that's a place I want to dig into a little bit more. So I don't have good examples in terms of where you're going to get great value yet, but I'm excited about looking into that because I while I've focused on a lot of family travel, I have not focused on kind of optimizing hotel redemptions for the kids, for the most part. I mean, we visited a few hotels with water slides and stuff. I mentioned Atlantis before, but I haven't focused very much. We've stayed at a lot of places that are probably more appealing to adults than to kids. And so I'm now becoming a little more curious about places where we can kind of have our cake and eat it too. Find a place that is appealing both to us and to the kids from various standpoints. So I'm looking forward to digging into that a little bit more someday soon.
Awesome.
That's awesome. I'm excited to, I'll be very excited to read that. And, you saying that also reminded me that we did create a kind of shared Google Maps. I don't know if they're groups or just a thing of like playgrounds, like you know, worldwide. And so we've got a number of members in the community add to that. And so I'll go ahead and I'll send you a note with that link if you're interested. There, you made me think of that because in Switzerland, and I can't remember the place specifically off the top of my head, but I think it's in that on that group. There's this cool restaurant, and it's got like it's pretty much you just let the kids go free reign. They've got slides, they've got like all the things that are interesting, and you can just sit and you're like in the mountains, just enjoying the view, and the kids can just sort of do as they wish, and it just seemed like a really cool experience. So I did tag it to that to that group and I'll share that.
Nice.
And for any listeners we'll of course be happy to share that. Nick, this has been absolutely awesome. We blew right past where we thought we would end, and the conversation just kept going and
not surprising.
No. This is why we do this, right? I mean, you know, just the natural dialogue and the insight that you've shared has just been incredible. I've got like 12 more tabs just from this conversation of things that I've got to go back and look at, just for myself. So, I mean, I thank you on behalf of Tom and I, and I thank you on behalf of our listeners for coming.
I'd like
on.
To thank you on behalf of myself.
Yes, there we go. Okay.
Well, since I thank both of you.
I will say every time we talk, I always learn something, and it's very rewarding. So really appreciate you having on the show.
Enjoyed being here. It's always a great time to talk about miles and points with folks who are knowledgeable about this stuff. And you guys made some fantastic points throughout the show, which doesn't surprise me, but it's enjoyable to be able to have that kind of back and forth. So always a great time here. Thank you very much for that. And I look forward to the next time when we're able to get together again and continue to listen to your show. You guys are doing a great job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's the show. Thanks for joining us. And we hope you enjoyed listening.
If you've enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a Milenomics Patreon member and get access to even more in-depth miles, points, and travel content.
Until then, we hope your next story is a travel story.